Hi, I'm Merrill McDonald. 27 years ago, I founded my firm, Gagan McDonald, on the premise that organizations don't transform, people do. Since then, as we've worked with many of the world's most admired global companies to navigate the human struggle of change, one thing has remained true. Leadership matters. A lot. Let Go and Lead is a podcast about what it takes to be a leader and how great ones balance the head and the heart to transform the companies that transform the world. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Marjorie Krause, a globally recognized master storyteller, innovator, and a remarkable leader with whom I've had the pleasure to work alongside in various capacities for almost two decades. As the founder and executive chairman of APCO, Marjorie's built a culture that values diverse perspectives and encourages emerging leaders to find strength in their unique identities. In our conversation, we'll explore the global approach at the heart of APCO, Marjorie's belief in distributing leadership, and how motherhood and womanhood helped her pioneer in business. We'll also delve into her experiences navigating the evolving landscape of leadership and the lessons she's gleaned from her impactful career. Whether you're leading a team, a company, or just beginning to step into your own leadership identity, there's something here for you. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Marjorie. Thanks so much for joining us. I've been so excited to interview you. As you know, I've wanted to do this for years. We always said we'd do it. We never got around to it. So here we are.
Well, I'm glad that day is here and hopefully I won't disappoint. But
we
could interview each other, I think.
Well, we've done that a bit too, huh? So anyway, first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on the 40th anniversary of APCO. It was just such an incredible milestone. And can you just tell us a little bit about how you started the firm and really why you started it?
Well, I wish I could tell a story that would have everybody sitting at the edge of their chair. But the truth is, it was a bit of an accident. I, as you know, Merrill, am a political scientist who taught high school. And I was involved in helping the Close Up Foundation as it grew over time. And I kind of got to know a lot of people and realized that I had a network where you could connect dots and solve problems. And there was a law firm in Washington that had a group of people that were doing more of project development than practicing law. And they always needed kind of talented non-legal professionals every time they did a thing. And they were doing really interesting things like the captioning that eventually was on public television and farms in the South for farmers and things that were just all over the place. And so I had been involved in helping when C-SPAN started of using the downtime on their satellite to have high school students talk to congressmen and create that kind of dialogue, which today would be a webinar. Nobody would think about it, but it was 1978 when this happened. And so it was a creative use of the space. And the law firm was also involved in helping cities with their cable franchises. And one thing led to another. And they asked if I would come in and help them think about how you partner in a way that gets these projects done and does a lot more of the kind of strategy and the non-legal pieces of what they were doing. And I thought it was an interesting idea. And I'd always been in the not-for-profit world. And I just thought I'd see what skills were applicable in another environment, probably in a very naive way. And then once I got in and saw that there's like no business plan and no budget or anything, I realized that I would have to come up with a concept and start to move forward if I wanted this to work in a way that offered the marketplace something they didn't have. And that's kind of the way it started. It wasn't like I woke up one day and said, I have this great idea. I wish I could say that, but I'm just not that smart. So it was an evolutionary concept.
Well, that was the start of a very entrepreneurial career, and you've certainly had a lot of other pioneering things along the way. Go, what do you think differentiates the firm?
I think, this also probably feeds into the fact that I didn't do this starting in the industry. I did this starting from the outside in. And so maybe I didn't know better, you might say. But the fact is that every kind of firm that was out there was a very niche firm. If you went to a lobbying firm, you got a lobbying answer. If you went to a PR firm, you got a PR answer. If you went somewhere else, that people's solution to your problem was what they sell, because that's what they know. And I thought there should be a place you can go where you talk about what your problem is, and people, it's agnostic about what tactics get used to solve the problem. And by accident or by good fortune or whatever, APCO became one of these very integrated firms. And we had people with all different backgrounds from the very beginning. So if somebody came with a problem or an opportunity, you looked at it afresh and you start to pull the pieces together with people with very different backgrounds. And the solutions you come up with were just different. The clients really liked the fresh thinking and the fact that it was a very bespoke solution for them. It wasn't something necessarily that had been tried a million times before. It wasn't a cut and paste. And so it just kind of caught on. And it was really word of mouth that did that. It wasn't, we were acknowledged as the least known but most respected firm in the marketplace. And everybody said, well, we should do something about it. I said, no, well, I don't want to be the best known and least respected. So I think we're on to something.
Well, you've built a global organization. I think at last count, you have 80 offices all around the world. And I know a lot of your philosophy has been blending local talent with global talent. How do you do that? What makes it work?
You know, I think it's half that many offices. We've worked in 80 countries, but the bricks and mortar are, you know, are about half. But it's still very global and very local, as I say. And that's a word that I've used as a guidepost all along. And I think the way you do it is, first of all, you have the ability to know what works and doesn't work, but not to know enough about another market, not to impose what has worked in one place with another. And so what we did from the very beginning, and this is why we did this organically, we couldn't find firms, even if we wanted to buy them. We couldn't find firms that actually had this kind of integrated model. So when we went into a country, we tried to find people who, first of all, believed in what we were doing and the way we were doing it. And then we would talk to clients about who are the very best people you've ever had working with you, and also to talk to people who succeeded or failed in the market. And we took that collective intelligence, and that's kind of how we shaped what we did locally. So we'd find people in a market that really knew the local market, were authentically of that market, but also had global interests and ambition and understanding. And so it was easy for them to work cross-border because they respected the people on the other side. And we were able to develop a culture that remarkably had people not with similar interests necessarily, but similar values, that they could respect each other, they could learn from each other, and that they found it fascinating to take the best of what somebody had done and apply it in another context. And so we had these very localized solutions using global standards, using a lot of things that, you know, the U.S. and eventually the U.K. that were the most advanced in the fields of communications or public affairs. And then we started going to places like, you know, China or Russia or somewhere else where there's nobody trained in this field. And so we were able to train people and shape them in a way that took advantage of the learnings we had had for years. So it was great. It was great to be able to do that. And it just, one thing kind of led to another. And once you do that a few times, you really have an instinct for what will work and won't work. Even though in some cases, the marketplace was a little bit confused because we weren't a siloed offer. And so they were trying to figure out where we fit. But then after a few years, like in Brussels, when we went in, we were saying we were public affairs and strategic communications, and nobody had really combined those things. In 5 years, everybody sold themselves that way. So, you know, part of it is taking risk. And if you think you're onto something, trying it, but also being flexible enough to stand back and say, this isn't working or this works. And I guess most importantly, to listen, because a lot of the reasons that companies failed, as we found out, is they took a model, let's say in the U.S., and they tried to apply it in Brussels. It's not the same. Some things are useful, But you have to be able to listen to the people there and learn from them and apply those things back. So it's the difference to me of being global or being international. You know, it's not a hub and spokes. It's actually a system where people are integrated in a way that they learn from each other.
And how did you inculcate that throughout the whole system? Because obviously you couldn't be in every country every day. So
I tried.
You were influencing. You do, though. I know. And of course, I can see you in a hotel room now because it's always, where in the world is Marjorie Krause?
Right. Unfortunately, that's what my family says, too. Yeah. You know, I think that if you find the right people and they're actually joining you because of a perspective or a set of values that you have or a vision you have, it's a lot easier for them to buy into that and then be evangelists for helping them. And from the very beginning, when we had these and people would say, you know, we just love the culture of this, I would say, then you have to replicate it. It's up to you. It's not up to me. I can enable things, but if you're going to make this work, you have to understand how to do that and how to translate this into local operations. And it's always a struggle because people come from other experiences and they don't really sometimes think it's going to work. And so there's resistance and you just have to keep at it. And you can't accept. So even if somebody is a fantastic performer, but they're really a function of their own way of doing things, it doesn't work in a system that where we depend on each other. And so you have to have the discipline also to recognize that some people just won't fit, even if they're very good people. And even if some other firm might think they're really great. And I'll tell you one other thing that as I reflect on these 40 years that I think made a big difference is partly because of our being self-financed. So part of it was budgetary, but I went out and found young people who were open to doing things differently. You know, the first employee in Brussels wasn't even 30 years old and had never really run anything like that, but he was a quick study and he was really smart. And it enabled me to help shape a culture as well. And now, 40 years later, some of the people that came in their 20s, you know, they're now running the company with 30 years experience. So I was very lucky to do that because I don't think we could have expanded as broadly and as globally if we didn't have the continuity of the people while we were bringing in all these new people. Because you're right, one person can't do that. You have to have a whole system of people that believe in what you're trying to do.
And you'd mentioned all these leaders who've come up over the years. And, you know, 8 years ago, you made a big decision to step back as CEO and become chairman to give more leadership to other people. What was that transition like for you as the founder?
Tough, but not unexpected. And this is also something I learned along the way. So when I started, the first office was Washington. And I was very much a function of that office. I was involved in everything. Well, you can imagine, you know, when you're one person and then you're 10 and then you're 20, you're deeply involved in, and when you know, you're all in startup mode, right? You're the one there New Year's Eve sending out fax, you know, in that day. So, but I, when we started to go to Europe, which was 10 years into the company being formed, I realized that, you know, I was doing a disservice to the company trying to run one thing and being somewhere else. So I had to step back. That was harder, actually, than stepping back 8 years ago, because I've done it now 3 or 4 times when something gets going of passing it on, training other people. And what I've learned is that if you have really good people, you have to give them the responsibility and authority together, because they may not do things the same way you did. And believe me, when I handed off Washington, it was to somebody who did things very differently than I did. But that didn't mean it was better or worse. He brought a different set of skills to the job and a different way of operating that I think helped the firm. And I didn't go away and still was very vocal. And we agreed on things and disagreed. And I think you learn a lot from that kind of exchange. So maybe I shouldn't even say this, but when it came to 8 years ago, I was turning 70, and I thought that it was going to be a problem for our team to be in limbo, like, what would happen if something happened to me? Or am I ready to sell the farm and they won't have a future? What's going to happen? And I also did it not just so I could do other things and other people could step in. And I was fortunate to have people could step in. I did it because I wanted to send a message to the company that we are here for the long term and that it's bigger than any one person and that the leadership and the management and the development of the firm had to be spread out. And then I found I didn't know what I was going to do because it was hard when you're involved in everything to let go. It really is hard. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. It's really, really hard. But what you find if you let yourself do that, and if you're entrepreneurial to begin with, is that there are, I forget the expression, when one door closes, another one opens, or, you know, the window opens or the door opens, whatever. But you get the picture that other opportunities come forward. And I think that APCO is in a very different place because I did that. And also, I don't have to worry about what happens if I drop dead. I'm going to hate to say it that way, but if something happened to me, there's a system in place and there are people in place. And yes, I know I'd be missed or whatever, but it's not as catastrophic as if I never did that.
It sounds catastrophic to me.
it's really catastrophic to me. I don't have any plan. I don't have any plans for that.
I know what you're saying, that the business is in a really great place. Yeah, which I've certainly seen. And, you know, I forgot to acknowledge up front that 2 years ago, just about this time, 2 years ago, APCO acquired Gega McDonald. So I'm now part of the family as well. And of course, we worked together for almost 20 years. So just formalized a longtime relationship. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of why I rest my case. If you can bring in people like Merrill, then you don't have to worry as much. You've diversified leadership and management, and you can rely on people whose skill sets are complementary. They may not be exactly the same, but that's a good thing because we learn from each other. And what's more joyful as you continue to grow your career than to be in the continuous learning situation?
You know, this kind of leads to a question I wanted to ask you about loyalty and relationships. Like, you've always inspired such an immense, immense loyalty from all the people around you, and you have so many relationships. You mentioned this goes back all the way to when you first started the firm. How do you actually do that, or what do you think is behind it?
Well, I'm talking to a master, so I have to be, you know, you should add to this. You know what? First of all, you have to like people, and you have to be authentic to those people. And if people can trust you, that you're going to be telling them the truth, that you really care about them and their future and everything, people are generous usually in return. I mean, not everybody is like that. You know, I've always tried to do little special things that, as you know, that are memorable to people, that just go that extra mile. And I don't do it for the reward of doing it. I do it because genuinely, it makes me feel good. And, you know, for many years until COVID, I wrote a personal anniversary card to everybody in the firm, even when we were 600-700 people. I stopped during COVID because I didn't have a way to get the cards to people in a timely way because they were given out in the office. And, you know, with all the privacy rules and everything else, I couldn't get everybody's home. It just became hard. And then it was hard to come back and do it. But nothing gave me greater joy than when I walked around offices in different parts of the world and people had those cards, those little cards tacked to their bulletin board. And it meant a lot. And I didn't do it. I never thought of it that way. But I realized that those little acts of kindness actually let people care and people reciprocate. And I even heard from there are some people at APCO who worked in other firms, and they tell me they never met the CEO or the leader of that firm, and they'd been there 5 years or 8 years or something. I find that just extraordinary. It just comes natural. I don't know. Maybe it's also, if I think about it and I'm honest, you know, I'm first generation. So my dad had a little general store, in a town of 3,000 people where we knew everybody because everybody shopped in the store. And, you know, my dad did so much on handshakes and relationships. And maybe it was just something that came natural because I was emulating the kind of way I was brought up and that you just go the extra mile. I don't know. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Well, I know family is so important to you. And in fact, you wrote a wonderful book called Roots and Wings. I have it right here.
There you go.
But what I love is the subtitle, 10 Lessons of Motherhood That Helped Me Create and Run a Company. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, APCO's an interesting place. And over the years, there's so many interesting stories. And people would say, you should write a book. Well, as you know, in this business, there's a lot of things you can't talk about, or you wouldn't, or things you wouldn't take credit for that you know you did. But it's up to the clients if they want to, you know, acknowledge that you're doing it on behalf of somebody else. And so, but I did have this one idea about the book, and not to write a book, but I had a sign on my kids' wall when they were growing up that there are only two lasting things of value you give your children. One is roots and the other is wings. And I always thought that was such a great concept. You know, you teach values, but then you got to let them go, and you hope that you did a good job teaching values so that they don't make big mistakes with their lives. And people started asking me what you asked before. How can you have offices across the world and have one common culture or one way of operating? And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, it's roots and wings. It's the same kind of concept. It's the same thing about, you know, having a set of values as a company. And then, you know, at least this is the aspiration. And then having people buy into that so that you can give them the freedom to do things. It's like freedom in a framework. And so then I started to think about what else did I learn from motherhood? And I realized that a lot of the way that I developed the firm or ideas I had or the way we treated people, relationships, as you said before, came from the way I raised my family. And when I was doing that, going back to when I started in, you know, in 84, but when I started working, it was 1970. And women, you know, you could be a nurse or a teacher. I mean, there weren't a lot of, if you did something else, people would say, you know, how'd you end up there? And so I wanted the next generation of women or the generation after that to understand that they shouldn't shy away from mother. You don't have to make the choice between motherhood and working. And that, in fact, what you learn from building a family is very helpful at work. And what you learn at work is helpful to build a family. And I thought, nobody's really talking about that. And I just wanted there to be a place that there was free, that I wanted to send a message, especially to our own people, that you should be proud of your whole life and bring your whole life to work. And you don't have to compartmentalize things. You don't have to hide the fact you're leaving early to go to a soccer game or a doctor's appointment. It's part of life, and we should support that. And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, it's really a great book. And there was one concept in there that I wanted to ask you about too. Well, probably several, but in the interest of time, I picked the praising publicly, criticizing privately. You know, I think on the face of it, that is very clear to people what you mean by that. But then there's also the challenge of when something happens in public that you want the others to know is not acceptable either. How do you manage that of dealing with the individual, but then also dealing with the greater collective?
Well, sometimes you can't manage it. And sometimes you get criticized for it. Why didn't you take action? Well, I did take action. I just didn't wear it on my sleeve, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think part of it is trust. I just don't personally think that you get very far humiliating people in front of their peers. You can pull people aside and talk to them afterward. You can make it clear that if it's egregious, I do a lot through humor. You know, if it's pretty well known that if I hate to say it this way, if a woman says something in a meeting and then two minutes later, a guy says it, somebody says, that's a really good idea. And, you know, it was said before. It's happened to me so many times. So I would stop there and just say, yeah, that is a great idea. And I thought it was really great when she said it too. You know, I mean, just not to make such a big deal out of it,
yeah,
but to do it in a way where you definitely would get the message of what that's all about. So, you know, so I think that's part of it. But I also think you get a lot more mileage from taking somebody aside when you could really have that conversation. And I think people respect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've mentioned women several times, and you have quite a reputation as being a real sponsor and champion of women. You were on the chairman of the board for I don't know how many years for Women's President's Organization, the largest women entrepreneurial organization in the world. You've been very involved in getting more women involved at Davos. What do you see is different now, if anything, I guess I should ask, do you think it's different for women now than it was when you were really doing all this back in the day?
I think there's an expectation, DEI aside, from what's going on right now, that women and men, that we have better results when we have a diverse workforce and when we have women and men working together, and that the outcomes, we all bring something different to the party and we should be able to celebrate that. And I think for a long time, I know how many times, and I know you have had this too, where you're the only woman in the room and you try to make a contribution. I always laugh it off and say, yes, they'll remember who I am because I'm not wearing a suit, you know, but you also have to, you know, be better prepared. And I think now there's more, I think the generation of women now don't see themselves as any different than men in the sense of being able to do things and being able to be rewarded for their work. It's still there's still a ways to go, but it's very different than when I was first in the workforce. Because I know a lot of times in the beginning, people would say, oh, you have children? Why are you working?
Like, and what did you say?
You're pregnant. Yeah, it's not contagious. Don't worry. No, you just work harder and try to demonstrate that, you know, you have to have a little bit of thick skin too, because some of it is really insulting. But I think every generation, it will probably get better. I hope so.
Well, I've often heard you quote Eleanor Roosevelt and say, never underestimate the power of being underestimated.
Well, actually, no. The quote I use from her is not to that you can't feel inferior without your own consent.
Oh.
But the never underestimate the power of being underestimated is my own. And it comes from a number of experiences I've had where we've ended up with the upper hand because you're just totally underestimated. And, you know, in 2004, APCO did a management buyout and a big bank was hired, which no longer exists. So I guess I can talk about this, but they were very condescending. And I knew at the end of the day that I had written in my contract that whoever bought those shares that I'd have to approve, but they looked right by it because they didn't think that there was a chance in hell that I'd be able to raise the money to do the management buyout. So on the last day, and you know, and I just bit my tongue the whole time. The last day when they told me who I was supposed to be working for, I just ended up saying, I don't think so. And they kept getting louder and louder. And I finally said, have you read my contract? And so they got fired. We did the management buyout and the rest is history. So I don't mean to be flip about it, but I think if you underestimate women, you do it at your own peril. And I like to think that rather than get offended, that you take advantage of the situation because it's deserved. If people are going to think of you that way, then it's at their own peril.
Well, you have so many things that are going to really create your legacy. But one of the ones that is most recent is APCO named its AI platform, Margi. And what does that really mean to you? And how are you really perceiving your impact relative to that?
So I'll answer it honestly, but I'll also answer it a little bit flip. To begin with, I did not know about this. I wasn't asked. And I don't know who on the staff. Somebody raised this as an idea, and everybody kind of jumped on that idea. So on the one hand, I think about people talking about you while you're in the room as a third party. It's just spooky sometimes to hear that. But on the other hand, and this is the part that I guess is serious part, it's a big honor that the team would have thought to do that, and that it represents the collective wisdom of APCO over the years, and that it will live a lot longer than I will. And besides, it's great to know I can speak 6 or 7 languages all at one time. I never could have done that on my own. So
and you can process global events in seconds.
Right. So, but you know, the other thing is it's named Margi. And as you know, I go by Marjorie. But I went by Margi my whole life until I was doing shows on C-SPAN. And I just thought that was kind of not mature enough or something. So I can almost tell how people know me over time by what they call me. And now to have this come back in my life, it's very confusing to me to hear all these people talk about Margi. Then I realize they're not talking about me.
And I've seen some people now getting tripped up where people call the AI Margi. It's kind of funny to watch.
That has been happening.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, another thing I wanted to ask you about, you've always coached young leaders to really learn from both positive and negative role models. You know, you've always taught them there's benefit.
Yeah, you know, when people ask me, like, who my role models are, I have many role models in the negative as I do in the positive, watching people saying, I never want to be like that.
What are some of the lessons you've learned from that?
Well, I do think the one about criticizing in public came from an experience I had with a previous boss who would get so mad he'd start foaming at the mouth and screaming at people. And it just did, you could just see it did no good.
Yeah,
I pulled him aside and talked to him about that because that it's not a way you get things done. But I do think, you know, the way leaders lead, we have clients who do this, who lead by dysfunction rather than by function. And you just see the waste that happens. People get spun out, they get demoralized. So I think you have to model behavior that you want other people to emulate. I don't think strength comes from proving you're in charge. You know, I think I've learned, because I was a teacher and then I was in a not-for-profit and then, you know, came to do this and now APCO's a fairly good-sized business and you learn a lot along the way. I think that what I've learned is to have the courage in my convictions. And for a long time, people would say, you've got to lead by authority. You've got to lead by, you know, this is a hierarchy. You have to make these decisions and you don't need to be listening to all these people. I think time has proven that's all wrong. And I think today, not just for me, but for the better leaders who are out there, it's really about, some people say servant leadership. I don't know exactly about that, but it is about respecting the people that work for you. It's a two-way contract. It's not something where it's not command and control. And especially today. And if you want the most out of people, you have to spend the time to make sure they understand why they're being asked to do certain things. It doesn't mean you coddle people. It means you give them honest feedback. And when it's not working, it's not working. But I think it's the honesty of that that's really, really important. And so I think that's what I've learned over time in watching other people lead. And I kind of made it a practice early in my career. When I was at Close Up, we would get funded by some of these big companies, and I got to know some of the CEOs. And I would like take them to dinner and almost suck their brain in a way. I was so curious. And you really got a perspective of how different people, what was important to them and how they use that in the way they led their companies.
And that leads me to a question that I ask all of our guests, because this podcast, as you know, is called Let Go and Lead. And the whole concept of it is an idea of how leaders not only what they lean into in terms of leading, but also what they need to let go of. What do you think is most important for leaders to let go of?
You know, I think we all need to know ourselves, and I don't think the answer is the same for everybody. Some people are really gifted at some things, and some people are really gifted at other things. I know, I've learned over time, I need to have people working with me who are very organized, who can help to with detail to follow through on things, because I'm all over the place. And I'm really good at big ideas. I'm good at strategy. I'm good at seeing something other people can't see. But if I'm going to execute that, I've got to have a team of people who are disciplined and who can tell me that's you're smoking something on that one, honey. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you got to, you know, think about what will work and not work. And so I think that for me, it's making sure that I'm not so obsessed with the detail that I feel I have to be part of every decision. For other people, it might be something totally different. And so I think part of that is just knowing yourself and what you're good at and not, and also being comfortable enough in your own skin and your own, and being secure enough in your own job that you are, you don't have FOMO. You don't, you know, because the worst thing I think a leader can do is dabble, come in and out of things. And especially at the last minute, when people have really thought through things and you're coming in a very disruptive way. If you had those good ideas and everything, you should have been engaged early on so people could take it and run with it. So it's more like helping, I like to help shape things in the beginning and then let people who maybe have more discipline, time, energy to take those things and really make them work.
So Marjorie, what's next for you that you're excited about?
You know what I'm really excited about? I think we live, I mean, this is a very confusing time for people. And there's a lot of disruption going on. Some of it is self-imposed with our elections and elections in other places. Some of it is AI. Some of it is, there's all different things. I think that there's an opportunity out of all of this to really rethink the way we do things and to try to come up with some models that look ahead and that take advantage of some of the things that are out there and not just do it in a kind of an iterative way. I think it's a time for bold new ideas. I think APCO's really good at putting them out there. And so I think it's a challenge to think about how we do things a little differently. A good example is right now, you know, there's all these attacks on these universities. We're working for a number of them, and as you know, we've both been trustees of university. And so you see from the governance side, there are real problems in higher ed with declining enrollments and the cost of education and some of the things that are, you know, that the ability to have diverse opinions on campus and all of those things. What kind of model should be out there for the future? Rather than say we have to put a patch over here, a patch over there. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other places in society where that's the case as well. How do we solve the childcare question for the long term? If we're really going to have a quality of life for people at work, how do we take the pressures of that out? Is there a different way to think about how we raise these kids? I mean, I could think of 100 of those things. So I'd like to take a chunk here and there and try to come up with solutions maybe that are unusual or different for the marketplace and see what happens. And as you know, another passion right now is taking a look at the African continent, all the cutbacks and aids, and the fact that I think by 2050 or 2060, one out of every four people in this world are going to live in Africa. And I think the average age now is 20 or something. I mean, that is a huge challenge, but a huge opportunity. So what can we all contribute? I don't even think it's monetary necessarily, but you know, what ideas are out there? Not for us to impose, but for us to build together. And so there's just no shortage of exciting things to do. I just know my runway is short, so I'm like in a hurry to keep going, but yeah.
Well, you've never let any grass grow, that's for sure. Thank you so much for your time. It really meant a lot to me. So glad to be able to do this.
Well, thank you for your partnership, Meryl. It's means a lot to me. And I know that you probably could have given the answers that I gave because I know how much we are like-minded about some things.
Well, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let Go and Lead. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. If you found this episode insightful, please follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to us on YouTube. And don't forget to check out past episodes and interviews on GaganMacDonald.com. Thanks for joining and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.